Welcome to this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last week on Radio Times, we heard about a new campaign called Women on 20s, which aims to replace Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill with a female American pioneer. Among the candidates for this honor is Frances Perkins, the oft-overlooked Secretary of Labor and friend to President Franklin Roosevelt. Perkins was the so-called moral conscience of the New Deal era and is now credited with spearheading some of the many social benefits that arose from that time, including Social Security, unemployment insurance, and the minimum wage. We'll now listen back to my conversation with biographer Kristen Downey, who joined me 6 years ago to discuss her book about Frances Perkins entitled The Woman Behind the New Deal. Now, you call Perkins FDR's moral conscience. How so?
Franklin Roosevelt was a brilliant man, but he was also cagey and did what was politically advantageous. What Frances Perkins did was explain to him and underscore to him again and again how doing what was in the public good would win him public support. She would come up with programs, explain why they were needed, explain how to do them, draft the language, and he would use his enormous political savvy to make them happen, and he would reap the credit.
How would you describe, then, their relationship?
I think they were best friends, and it's unusual because we very seldom see in either literature or history descriptions of a deep friendship between a man and a woman that isn't based on a romantic tie or anything. It was just that they were two people that worked together extraordinarily well, understood each other's strengths and weaknesses, and were a very effective team. And, of course, with the help of Eleanor Roosevelt, Franklin's wife, popularizing the things they were doing so effectively.
How would you describe, or was there a relationship between Perkins and Eleanor Roosevelt?
Well, this is something that's very interesting. As we all know from a lot of the recent scholarship on Eleanor Roosevelt, in many ways she had a difficult life. She was orphaned as a child. She was married to a very handsome man who was unfaithful to her. She had good reason to be insecure. She had an unusual situation in that her husband had chosen a woman to work with so closely in Frances Perkins. So in some ways, Eleanor was nervous about Frances, but they were also extremely important allies to each other. They shared the same goals and the same sense of what needed to be done to make things work effectively.
How shocking and controversial was it that FDR chose a woman to head the Department of Labor?
Well, it was regarded with horror, particularly by the union movement. A lot of the union leaders had thought that one of them would be selected to be labor secretary. And then it was even worse that a woman was selected, because we need to remember at this time, most labor unions didn't permit women to be members of unions. So to have a former social worker and government official who had been selected to head the agency, but also a woman, was a double blow.
And why do you think he did it? I mean, was it that he just believed in her? He saw her as the best person for the job at the time?
Well, yes, she was. And it's interesting because a lot of accounts have seemed to suggest that he plucked her from obscurity and put her in the post. But in fact, she had known him since 1910. Right. So when he picks her in 1932, they've already known each other for 22 years. She's been his industrial commissioner in the state of New York for the previous 4 years. She's already been serving in his cabinet. And he gets hundreds of letters of support for her candidacy from people all over the country who know how much she knows about labor law and administration.
Would you say that she was part of the early feminist movement in the beginning of the 20th century?
Oh, absolutely. She was one of the earliest and most ardent suffrage leaders of the 20s. Now, remember, there were waves of suffrage movement, and there was a more militant movement that grew up in the 19-teens, and she's part of that movement. She's one of those women that goes and takes a soapbox, and they'd go to a corner where there was a bar on each of the four corners. They'd stand up on the soapbox. Usually a friend would accompany them and hold a banner. They'd start to talk, and men would come out to hear women talk about the right to vote. Hmm. That was the best location for drawing a crowd. And it also meant that you learned how to bring a crowd around that might have been inclined to ridicule you.
Interesting.
So this is where she learned to talk to a hostile crowd and try to turn their opinion around, and where she learned that speaking to like-minded people doesn't advance you. You have to convince people who don't share your views.
She also, I guess social worker might be the right word, but she did work in Chicago with immigrants. She also worked here in Philadelphia.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons I was so pleased that you invited me to speak with you today. Philadelphia has a very strong association with Frances Perkins. She really started her professional social work career in Philadelphia, and there's a lot of accounts of her striding up and down Walnut Street as she thinks about things that need to be changed. She attended classes at Wharton Business School, and again, that was one of the things that was very unique to Philadelphia, is its open-mindedness about education for women, and she took advantage of that. When her own daughter went to go to college, Frances Perkins chose a Philadelphia college for her daughter in Bryn Mawr.
Talk a bit, if you would, about how other members of FDR's cabinet then viewed Frances Perkins.
Well, it's interesting because, in fact, she was a close ally to a number of them. In some cases, in some ways, so important to their own careers that it might have made them uncomfortable. FDR didn't know Harry Hopkins, and it was Frances Perkins that brought Harry Hopkins to FDR's attention and launched him in the PWA program that was one of the early sources of employment all across the country. And, of course, Harry Hopkins goes on to become a very close friend to FDR, even living in the White House. Frances Perkins' closest ally on the cabinet herself was Henry Wallace, the Secretary of Agriculture, and they met on the very first day of FDR's inauguration. There's a wonderful account of them rushing together to try to get to the inauguration ceremony on time, running, there's a wonderful account of her running in high heels up the Capitol lawn trying to get there, but, you know, for FDR's speech. But there was such a close friendship between the two of them. She thinks so highly of Henry Wallace that she touts him very highly to FDR, and FDR ends up picking Henry Wallace as his vice presidential candidate in 1940.
Boy, that just shows the extent of her influence. You also described the Labor Department, this is back in the 1930s, as completely dysfunctional, quote-unquote gangster-ridden. What was the department like when she took over?
When Frances Perkins took over, the Immigration Department was part of the Department of Labor. And actually, that makes a lot of sense because a lot of immigration-related issues are worker and workplace-related questions. But in the 1920s, the sentiment against immigrants was very strong. The United States had shut down immigration into the United States for all intents and purposes. And what that meant is it became lucrative business to accept bribes for permitting people to stay who could have otherwise been deported, or even blackmailing people who were legally here but who could be threatened with a deportation. And there was a large crowd of immigration officials who were actually shaking down immigrants for money. When Frances Perkins came in as Secretary of Labor, she had to clean that out.
And she was able to do it?
Yes, yes, and a number of them went to jail.
She also, and this would again be a reflection of the times, desegregated the cafeteria.
Yes, the offices were very dirty when she got there, and she saw cockroaches in the desks, and she wondered why, and then she realized that the black employees were not allowed to eat in the cafeteria. They were bringing their lunch to work in bags or boxes, and it was attracting bugs. And that was when she first realized that the cafeterias were actually segregated in the Labor Department building. One of her early actions was to order it desegregated.
That's a pretty powerful thing to do back in the 1930s.
Well, it was, and it was also one of the things that Frances Perkins did with no fanfare and not calling attention to herself.
Let me ask you about Congress's relationship with Frances Perkins. Congress even went so far as to try to impeach her. What was that about?
Yes. Well, Franklin Roosevelt had a very difficult constituency in a way. He led the Democratic Party, but the Democratic Party was very splintered. There were the Northern liberals and the Southern conservatives. And in fact, it was the Southern conservative Democrats that controlled a lot of the key committee chairmanships in the House and Senate. They were often hostile on some level to some of the New Deal legislation that Frances Perkins was proposing, and they were also more inclined to not like having a woman in that role. She had to try to find ways to placate them.
And they did try to impeach her.
And they did. After the Fair Labor Standards Act passed in 1938, there was a lot of outcry. It's really interesting because there's been a lot of said recently that business was always opposed to Roosevelt from the start. From my extensive research, that's really not true. In fact, Roosevelt got a standing ovation from the Chamber of Commerce in 1933 for the things that that he was doing to stimulate the economy. But as the new rules came in, And as business leaders recovered their nerve, more opposition grew to the New Deal principles, including ban on child labor, the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage. Frances Perkins was very closely associated with that. But in 1939, this growing group of enemies of Frances Perkins actually moved to impeach her because they said that she had failed to deport a union organizer who was Australian named Harry Bridges, who was believed to be communist.
Huh. Now, when she was actually FDR's choice for labor secretary, did she have to go before Congress to get their approval?
Yes. Yes, she did, and it happened fairly easily. They were all confirmed quite easily. There was an enormous sense of the desperation of the times that there was not a lot of fight over who would be confirmed or not. It happened amazingly quickly.
Now, she stayed in the FDR administration, she, of course, being Frances Perkins, obviously until his death. Did she stay into the Truman administration as well?
She stayed a few months into the Truman administration. FDR was so devoted to her that he would not let her step down, even though she repeatedly asked. At one point, he even said to her, "Oh, Frances, how can you be so selfish?" when she tried to resign. She also knew Truman, though. She'd known Harry Truman and first met him when she was campaigning for Al Smith for president. So she had a friendship with Truman as well. She stayed a few months into his administration, then was essentially asked to resign. An aide to Truman said that the men around Truman said that they wouldn't be comfortable working with a woman. Truman did call her back, and she worked in the Civil Service Commission. So she worked well into her 70s, and then she spent the last of her working life at Cornell as a visiting lecturer, where she taught on industrial and labor relations.
What was her relationship then with the union movement or union leaders when she was in the FDR administration?
It was an uneasy relationship in many ways. They privately loved her and personally remained embarrassed to have a woman leading the movement. She had also been key in writing legislation that allowed the vast organization of the American workforce. Millions of people joined unions during the 1930s thanks to legislation that she had helped to craft. But it also spawned a big rivalry within the labor movement between the more traditional AFL and the more upstart radical CIO. So she was also having to preside over a war within the union movement, even as the union movement grew. They were jealous of their own power. She would have to try to calm the struggles and try to move things ahead. Publicly, they would criticize her. But her memory is revered now at the AFL headquarters. There's a room named after her, and at the AFL-CIO headquarters, I spoke to 180 union people with President John Sweeney there to hear eagerly about just how Frances Perkins had done what she did.
That was my 2009 conversation with biographer Kristen Downey about her book, The Woman Behind the New Deal. When we get back, we'll listen to my conversation with Joshua Forer, who wrote about competitive memorization and chronicled his experience competing in the United States Memory Championship in his 2011 book, Moonwalking with Einstein. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscoane. As we speak, there are a small number of Americans in training for the competition of their lives. This training is not taking place in a gym or on a field. It's taking place in their mind. That's because this Sunday is the 18th annual United States Memory Championship being held in New York City. Competitors will test their abilities in memorizing number sequences, lists of objects, and even the order of a shuffled deck of cards. We learn about this contest and the various tricks of competitive memorization when author Joshua Forer joined us back in 2011. His book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything, chronicled his training for and participation in the United States Memory Contest, where he won first prize. Let's listen. You write about the fact that you went to this memory championship thinking that they would be a bunch of savants with photographic memories, and actually learned that it really was a matter, as you just mentioned, a matter of techniques and skills and a training regimen to help develop this artificial memory.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the fascinating things I learned, which was news to me, is that photographic memory is a myth. Photographic memory doesn't exist. It's one of the most commonly propagated myths about memory, but there's exactly one case in the scientific literature of somebody who is able to take a picture with their mind's eye and repeat it back as though it were a Xeroxed copy. That was in 1970. It was a paper published in Nature, one of the most famous scientific journals in the world. Most psychologists now believe it's bunk. Nobody has ever been found with this ability. They ran ads in newspapers all over the world. If you've got a photographic memory, come forward now. And they never found anyone.
Well, you trained with a guy named Ed Cook. Tell us about him.
At the time I met him, he was getting a degree in cognitive science at the University of Paris. And I met him outside the competition hall at the Con Edison headquarters, which is where this contest was held. And he was smoking a cigarette. And he said to me, "You're a journalist. Do you know Britney Spears?" And I said, "No, I don't know Britney Spears." And he said, "Well, I'd really like to teach Britney Spears how to memorize a deck of playing cards on U.S. television. It'll prove to the world that anybody can do this." And I was like, "Okay, well, maybe you could teach me. I mean, you got to start somewhere." And that's how this whole journey began.
And he's a guy who has remembered huge passages of Paradise Lost, just to put him into some kind of context. And it seems like he challenges himself and does almost daily memorization routines.
Yeah, I mean, he takes this all very seriously. And I guess you would say he approaches it in a way like a scientist. His philosophy is, look, there are two ways you can understand how memory works. One is the way empirical science does it, mm-hmm. which is running all sorts of tests and doing it under controlled conditions. Another way to figure out some of the principles of how our memories work is to really push oneself and see how much you can make yourself remember and what you can learn about the brain from doing that. So it's kind of a neat philosophy.
Well, he has an interesting thing to say about solitary confinement. Can you talk about that?
that's another one of his philosophies of life.
Just to put him in the context here. Yes, go ahead.
He once told me that his philosophy of life is that a person should be able to withstand several years in solitary confinement without getting overly bored with himself. And to do that, it helps to have a whole lot of poetry in one's memory to refresh oneself with.
But that tells us a lot about his mind, his imagination, yes? His brain.
Yeah, it does. And you know, one of the things that I discovered over the course of this training with these techniques is that it's actually a lot of fun. I mean, I never would have guessed that memorizing would be fun. But the art of all of this, the art of this competition, the art of even memorizing something as seemingly boring as, you know, thousands of random numbers is actually about creating imagery in your mind's eye and creating bizarre, weird, colorful, strange, sometimes raunchy pictures in your mind's eye and creating things that are so unforgettable that you're just not going to be able to shake them.
Because that's what our mind, our brain, our memory, that's what it latches on to, something that's novel and surprising and maybe raunchy?
Sure. I mean, if you were walking down the street and you saw Brooklyn Decker swing by in a swimsuit and she was – you know, being pelted with tomatoes, and that's the kind of thing you simply would not forget. That would draw your attention, and it would also draw your mind's eye. And that's what you're trying to do in these memory competitions, is turn things that are forgettable into images that are unforgettable in your mind's eye.
He gave you – this would be Ed Cook. He gave you a list of things to memorize, and I'll read the list, and then you can tell us how you did this. One is it begins with pickled garlic, cottage cheese, salmon, peat smoked if possible, 6 bottles of white wine, socks, 3 pairs, 3 hula hoops, spare, snorkel, dry ice machine, email Sophia, skin tone catsuit, find Paul Newman film, somebody up there likes me, elk sausages, megaphone and director's chair, harness and ropes, and barometer. That was the list, I guess, your first list of things to memorize. Let's start with the pickled garlic.
Right. Now, I'm still not clear on what pickled garlic is, actually.
I don't know the answer to that either, but go ahead.
But the idea is, and this all goes back to a technique that was supposedly invented 2,500 years ago in ancient Greece by a poet called Simonides. And it's known as the memory palace. And the idea is to take a building or a route that you know well and that you're intimately familiar with and impose upon it imagery representing the things that you want to recall later. So in this case, to remember that list, the first step would be to actually visualize pickled garlic, like at the foot of my parents' driveway. If we're using my parents' house that I grew up in Washington, D.C. as our memory palace, the pickled garlic is right there at the front foot of the driveway, and you try and see it with as much color, as much smell, as much engaging all of your senses in the act of imagining that pickled garlic. And then the next item, I believe, was cottage cheese.
Yes.
Ed said, you know, what you should do with this is imagine a big tub of cottage cheese sort of on the walkway up to the front door of this house. And just to make it a little bit more memorable, why don't you put Claudia Schiffer in the tub of cottage cheese and imagine her just bathing in dairy? You know, that image is just unforgettable. And that's actually advice, you know, putting Claudia Schiffer in the cottage cheese that goes back to some of the earliest writings on how to train the memory. One of my favorite anecdotes is a little piece of advice that was offered by a 15th century mnemonist named Peter of Ravenna, who said, you know, if you really want to make your memory palaces memorable, you should use images of young virgins in your memory palaces, because the mind is just drawn to that. So that's one of the techniques, is to sort of make things raunchy and lewd.
Well,
and that's what we were doing with Claudia Schiffer.
And we'll get to some of the other images that you use, but even this notion of a memory palace, so that the memory is a kind of place, and it also is something you can see. And you mentioned in this book that if someone invites you to their house and they take you on a tour of that house, you actually remember a lot of what that house looks like, where the furniture is, where the photographs are, and that the memory is, I guess, a visual thing.
Yeah, I mean, you'd walk out the door of that house with actually a whole lot of information in your skull. We don't register that as a feat of memory, but if you think about it, it is. There's a whole lot of data that you've just collected. And part of what technique like the memory palace does, or other memory techniques, is taking something that we actually are really good at remembering, like space, and transforming it so that you're using that kind of memory that we're good at to remember things that we're not as good at.
Temple Grandin was a guest on this show, as she has been on a lot of shows, and she wrote a book about her mind and memory, about thinking in pictures. And for her, language are images. They are pictures for her, and that's how she deconstructs the world. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, and in my book, I write about a character named S,
yes.
Who's a real famous individual in the psychological literature. S remembered too much. He also thought in images. And everything that he saw, everything that he read, immediately conjured up this whole world of synesthetic images in his mind. And it was so effective at making him remember things that he was effectively dysfunctional. He remembered too much. He couldn't distinguish between the things that were worth remembering and the things that weren't worth remembering. And that points to something interesting, which is that it's actually not remembering so much as forgetting, in a certain respect, that makes us thinking people.
Because the idea that to remember everything is to be overwhelmed with information and images, I guess.
That's right. It's to be swimming in a sea of trivialities, which is what happened to S.
Well, and you also write, and this is fascinating to me, S says here, and I'm quoting, "Take the number one, this is a proud, well-built man. Number two is a high-spirited woman. Three, a gloomy person. Six, a man with swollen feet. Seven, a man with a mustache," going on from there. The idea that these abstract numbers are animate objects to him.
They take on personality and color and emotion, and actually, that's exactly what a trained somebody who's competing in one of these memory contests, learning to memorize thousands of numbers, is teaching themselves to do. They're giving color and emotion to every number.
And even this list that your teacher gave you, which goes on after the cottage cheese, and I guess forever I will have that image that you have now of cottage cheese on your parents' driveway, and followed by salmon. What was the image that you associated with salmon?
He asked me to try and imagine some peat-smoked salmon curing on the bed of a grand piano, which I can still smell. I actually thought it was a little bit easier to remember locks, which is more familiar to me than peat-smoked salmon. But he's British. I come from Eastern Europe, you know.
And that's where the locks
to each his own.
Exactly. Right. Now, the title of your book, Joshua, is this mnemonic device that you developed so that you can memorize two decks of playing cards. Can you explain to our listeners how that worked?
Sure. I should first of all explain that there are a whole host of different techniques that people use for different competitions, and some of them are more advanced than others. And there is a tradition that in Europe and in England and in Germany especially, these techniques are the most developed. And so the one that I was using to remember a deck of cards is one that Ed taught me, which at the time was being used in England but not in the United States. And it involved turning playing cards into images of essentially celebrities performing lewd acts on objects. Hence, we get Einstein moonwalking with the white diamond-studded glove, which is a hard image to shake. That helped me remember a few playing cards.
And you also have Dom DeLuise, a celebrity fat man. He was the five of clubs, yes?
Yes, that's true.
Who else did you use in your deck?
Let's see. There are all sorts of people who have had various indignities performed on them. Bill Clinton was the king of diamonds. Hillary Clinton was the queen of diamonds. John Goodman was the king of clubs.
And your grandmother figured into this, too. Did she know?
Yeah, unfortunately, my grandmother was the eight of hearts. And, you know, part of what happens in the act of doing this, all this remembering is that you're recombining these images in weird ways. And probably forced my grandmother into some situations that I am embarrassed to say I had to imagine.
Did you take her out of your deck finally, or she lived in there?
I've reconciled myself to the fact that my subconscious will simply have to be tormented by it.
But it seems like to an outsider that in order to memorize two decks of cards, which you were able to do, that your mind has to go through an extra step, which is to take, let's say, the five of clubs, turn it into Dom DeLuise, and then I guess put it back in the deck.
Yeah, no, it takes a certain amount of remembering to be able to remember. And, that's part of what I was training with during that year. I was learning these techniques and how to employ them really, really, really fast.
You also wore headphones, I guess, when the competition came around?
Yeah, when it gets to the highest level in this sport, it's all about concentration. So everybody who competes wears earmuffs. Most people who compete wear earmuffs on top of earplugs because you can never be deaf enough. And then if you're really, really into it, you wear essentially blinders, almost like some people actually compete wearing horse blinders. But if you can imagine sunglasses that have been completely masked over except for two small pinholes. And the idea is you don't want to be seeing or hearing anything that's not exactly what you're trying to commit to memory.
So what was it like the morning of or the day of the actual competition? And this goes back 5 years to 2006. But what was that like?
Well, naturally, I couldn't sleep the night before, which is essentially like the equivalent of kneeing a soccer player with a club, right before the big game. Sleep is absolutely the most essential ingredient to being able to perform these tasks. Nevertheless, I showed up. The contest is a little bit like the SATs. It's a bunch of people sitting at desks, furiously scribbling away the things that they've been asked to remember and then handing in their sheets at the front of the room. There's one event where five strangers get up on stage and read off just all of this biographical information about themselves, their names, what kind of a car they drive, their favorite food, their phone number, their zip code, and you have to remember as much of that as possible for all five people. That was one of the harder events.
And why do you think that was?
Because the information was coming in a sort of unstructured way, you had to very quickly structure it and come up with ways to make it memorable. I was at the U.S. contest this year, which happened just this past weekend, and it was remarkable to see the development in how people have figured out ways to remember all of that information better today than they could when I competed just 5 years ago. This time around, almost all of the competitors remembered almost all of the information. Every year, it just gets better and better and better.
And why do you think that is? Just that there's more research about how the mind works?
People are using better techniques that they figured out, and those techniques end up getting spread by word of mouth from competitor to competitor. And also, people take it more seriously every year. This quote-unquote sport is growing in popularity, and the people who are competing are taking it to higher and higher levels. Just this past year, somebody set a new world record by memorizing a deck of playing cards in 21.9 seconds, which, from my perspective, is absolutely extraterrestrial.
Well, you won, and you were, I guess your competitive event was memorizing two decks of cards?
Yeah, that turned out to be one of my better events, that and memorizing people's names. One of the events they also give you is a list. They give you 100 photographic headshots and first and last names associated with them, and you have 15 minutes to commit those to memory. Playing cards was one of my strongest events, and I memorized a deck in a minute and 40 seconds, which at the time was a U.S. record. That record has subsequently fallen many times over.
So what do you win when you win the USA Memory Championship?
I wish I could say respect or that people would think you were cool. But the truth is all you win is a trip to the World Championships, which that year were held in London.
And how did you do there?
Well, I came in really taking this is a great responsibility to represent the United States of America. I mean, this was a position I had never expected to be in, having entered this whole thing as a kind of experiment in participatory journalism. I ended up totally getting wiped out. I mean, just destroyed by the Brits and the Germans and the Malaysians.
Was it a fluke that you had won the USA, or it's just the competition is pretty stiff out there?
You know, on the international memory circuit, Americans are thought of sort of as the Jamaican bobsledders of the whole competition. We're a little bit, or have been, traditionally behind the curve in terms of the techniques and training that we undergo here on this side of the Atlantic.
Joshua, I have to say, reading your book took me back to probably 7th or 8th grade or 9th grade, memorizing The Wasteland or the Gettysburg Address. And you had mentioned it's important to make it fun. I had no fun associated with that kind of memorization, which was, you know, pretty rote. But the idea, I guess, of creating these images helps to make it more playful and more fun.
Yeah, and I apologize if anything that I've written has forced you to to go back to those awful years of middle school. But yes, I mean, part of what made this enjoyable process was that it was fun. I mean, I wouldn't have never imagined that memorizing stuff would be fun, but that's really the art of it.
Does it also tell us that we have, you'll pardon this, you know, dirty minds in that things that are sexual or disgusting or novel, our mind just gravitates to that?
It does seem to be the case that we're kind of wired to find that sort of thing interesting and to find that sort of thing memorable. That's what you're taking advantage of when you're competing in one of these contests.
And that was my 2011 interview with Joshua Forer, author of Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. And we hope you took notes. After the break, we're going to revisit my conversation with acclaimed jazz trumpeter and Philadelphia native, Terrell Stafford. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Coaim. 2 years ago, Philadelphia native and acclaimed jazz trumpeter Terrell Stafford started the 17-piece Jazz Orchestra of Philadelphia. It's a nonprofit organization aimed at keeping the spirit and vitality of jazz music alive in Philadelphia. Stafford, who was also director of jazz studies at Temple University, was called one of the great players of our time by Philadelphia piano great McCoy Tyner. The classically trained musician joined me in the studio in 2013 to discuss his life growing up in Philadelphia and his work in education and in music. Let's listen. What does a trumpet allow you to do? I know you've been playing this instrument since you're about 13 years old.
For me, it's self-expression. That's what it really allows me to do. And it can really reflect any mood I'm in. And, you know, sometimes I can be pretty vocal, but if I'm not, the trumpet can represent what I'm thinking, who I am, what I feel.
Did you play other instruments as a kid before you came to the trumpet?
I did. I started out playing the viola.
Oh, really?
It was a disaster.
Why?
Well, I was awful. I was god-awful. And my teacher would hit me on the fingers for every wrong note. And I was notorious for playing a lot of wrong notes. I was probably the most popular in the class with the wrong notes. And so after him constantly hitting me with this bow, I one day decided to block his bow, and my bow hit him in the middle of the face, cracking his glasses, and him suspending me from school for a week and from music for a year, and had my parents come in and said, "Your son has no musical talent whatsoever. Keep him as far away from music as humanly possible."
Wow.
So that was my first experience. And so the year that I wanted to start to play the trumpet, I was suspended from music. So then after that year, wow, I could play the trumpet.
So who put the first trumpet in your hands?
My grandparents, they lived in Florida, and my cousin played trumpet, and he had his trumpet in the closet. And, you know, being a kid, you know, when grandma says, "Don't go in that closet," you're going to go in that closet. And I went in the closet and picked up the trumpet. And then if she would go and run errands in town, I'd take it out and I'd play it and I'd put it back before she got home. So I knew
you were a mischievous kid.
I was pretty bad, yeah.
And was it kind of love at if not first sight, first, what, First hold.
Yeah.
First hold.
I mean, I thought it was a fascinating instrument in that it only had three vowels. I was like, wow, three vowels. This must be really easy. All these other, like saxophones, have all these keys and piano, you know. So trumpet must be pretty easy. And it's probably one of the more difficult instruments I've played. Yeah.
You grew up in Miami.
Yeah. Born in Miami, near the Coral Gables area is where I started school because my mother was a teacher. So I went to school where she taught because it was just easier that way. And then my father got a job for the railroad, and we started to move every 4 years. So then we moved to the Chicago area, and I lived there, and that's where I actually started to play trumpet.
Right.
And then we moved from there, from my high school, to Maryland, and I went to a high school in Maryland.
So what kind of music in your house? I mean, what did your parents listen to, or your grandparents?
My grandparents really didn't listen to much music, unless it was gospel music. That's what they listened to. My parents listened to everything, you know, R&B, you know, Stevie Wonder was always playing. And my dad actually went to school with Cannonball Adderley.
Really?
So, yeah, he played a lot of, he loved Cannonball, so he played a lot of that. And he actually wanted me to play jazz starting out, and I just didn't want to because my peers all played classical music. So I said, I'm just going to follow the flow and do that. And, you know, it was great that I played classical music for most of my life.
Yeah, in fact, you studied classical music, and I guess, I don't know if it's considered late to come to jazz, but you were, I guess, maybe older when you came to jazz?
I was in my early 20s when I started to really take it serious, and many factors led me to it. One being that one of my trumpet heroes is a guy named Bud Herseth, who was principal of the Chicago Symphony, and in a masterclass I attended that he was giving, he spoke about his favorite trumpet player was Clark Terry and, you know, how much he loved jazz. And it kind of shocked me. I was like, wow, my hero, the principal of Chicago Symphony, likes jazz. And he said, I asked him, and he goes, sure. He goes, you know, every Sunday after church, I go play in a Dixieland band.
Oh, my goodness.
It's my favorite thing to do. Wow. And then he started to speak about, you know, the greatest musicians do it all. He goes, it's the ones who speak ill about one genre or the other that kind of reveal their musicianship. And that was really interesting. So I said, maybe I should learn some jazz and that could help my classical playing. And lo and behold, it's my career.
Do you think classical helped your jazz playing though?
Absolutely. I mean, the repertoire, the great teachers that I've had, the fun, you know, learning the fundamentals of your instrument, being as tedious as possible when it comes to sound and it comes to articulation, so on and so forth.
And the notes, I guess.
Yep, and the notes and the colors. And so when I started to play more jazz, those fundamental things were somewhat settled.
I don't know if I was being overly dramatic in my introduction and saying that you attended Rutgers University by day and playing with the Bobby Watson's Horizon Quintet by night. Did I get that right?
That was really, really great.
Was it close enough?
It was great, yeah. It was very close to that, yeah. Near the end of my graduate studies, I did meet Bobby Watson and started to go out on the road with him. Yeah. But I couldn't tell anyone that I was going on the road with Bobby Watson because I was a classical major, and if I were going to go on the road, it had to be with a classical group. So I said that
there's
I was,
a pattern here I'm seeing it in your life.
Yep. So I said, I'm going on the road with the Robert Watson Chamber Ensemble. And the school was very proud of me until the band showed up on the cover of Downbeat.
And you were in trouble again?
I was in trouble again. Another suspension.
Were you suspended again?
For a year. Academic probation is what they call it. But it was worth it. I got to go on the road with Bobby Watson. And he was the beginning of my career in jazz.
Did you have to unlearn any things that you learned as a classically trained trumpet player?
You know, I don't know if I had to unlearn anything. I think I had just to adapt to a different way of doing things. So everything that I learned, I could present just in a different way, you know. Mm-hmm. The thing that was hardest for me was creating. I had the freedom to create, and that was difficult at first because I was like, what do I play? And it's just like speaking. That's what I learned, you know. The more vocabulary you acquire in your, you know, growing up, the more you can express yourself. And the same thing with music. The more vocabulary that I got, the more solos that I would learn and the more players I would go out and hear, the more I could express myself through a jazz vehicle.
You've been a sideman and probably still in a lot of different bands. I'm assuming that helps as well. I mean, learning to sort of listen and be part of a different kind of a group.
It does help as well. And in some ways, in some really strange ways, I enjoy being a sideman more because,
really?
I can experience more, I can learn more. Sometimes as a leader, leading a group sometimes is very self-sacrificial, you know, because you want everyone to be happy all the time. So you're kind of forgetting about yourself. You're kind of forgetting about this, and you're always serving the members of the band and making sure they're comfortable. And sometimes when you're the sideman, you get to receive some of that, you know.
Some of that love, right?
Yeah, some of that love. And, you know, just playing different folks' music all the time, no matter where I go, I can just figure out what they want. And it's great. As a sideman, some folks want you to play their concept, and others just want you to bring who you are to what they've written. So it's a really interesting life.
Mm. What's your style of teaching? I'm curious.
I think my style of teaching is through experience. As far as jazz goes, the reason that I love to teach jazz is because I had to learn it all myself. I love to teach all music, but with jazz especially, if I wanted to figure something out, I did the work for it. You know, it wasn't a teacher that said, here's what you have to do necessarily. And because of that, students that have the same struggles that I did with maybe time or feel or maybe harmony or melody, I experienced it all, so I can share that, you know. And sometimes if you have a teacher that's, you know, a total genius and it was all gifted.
Right, this came right to them.
Yeah, it's hard for them to kind of explain that. But I've had enough troubles with jazz, with playing the trumpet in general, that when students do have problems, that passionate, empathetic side of me comes out, and that's how I teach, through my experience, through my learning.
And not like the guy that was telling you were terrible viola player.
Yeah, and I don't take out a bow in my lessons enough.
Very good. You mentioned the fact that for 6 months you were a computer programmer. Mm-hmm. I mean, happily, unhappily?
It was pretty miserable.
Yeah.
Because I didn't play the trumpet at all. But it was good money, and my hours were super easy. So I'd have to get to work maybe 5 in the morning, and I was able to leave at like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. And after I'd gone to see Wynton and the Eastman Wind Ensemble, that job was really great because I would wake up early and be home at 2 or 3. And then when I got inspired to play again, I used the rest of the day to prepare for my graduate school auditions.
I want to ask you a little bit about the Jazz Orchestra of Philadelphia and sure. What the thinking is behind that.
It's funny, you know, when two minds are working parallel but in different spaces. Dina Adler, who's the founder of the group and one of the founders of the group, she was thinking about why doesn't Philadelphia have a jazz orchestra? And all these major cities have jazz orchestras. So, and I was playing the Pittsburgh Jazz Festival. And I was at the festival, and I just finished performing, and I see on the side of this building, it said, you know, come hear the Pittsburgh Jazz Orchestra led by Sean Jones. And I said, wow, you know, and I started to speak to some of the Pittsburgh musicians, and they're like, yeah, it's really great for the city. You know, we can highlight some of the great players and the great talent in the city. Every city should have one. And so they're like, why doesn't Philadelphia? And I said, that's a good question.
Yeah.
And then when I returned from that trip, that's when the first meeting was had, probably last summer, about Philadelphia, you know, having a jazz orchestra. And so now it's great because, I mean, there's so many great musicians from Philadelphia. There's so many great musicians who reside in Philadelphia. And, you know, in any city, you know, that sense of community is really important. And so bringing all these fabulous musicians from any walks of life to come together and to make the best music possible for the city and represent the music and sound of the great composers and arrangers of this city is really, really important.
Do you think there's a Philadelphia jazz sound? And I ask you that. We know about the Philadelphia Orchestra has this very distinctive sound of the string section.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's a Philly jazz sound?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, when you think about, to me, the Philly jazz sound, the first thing that comes to my mind is just soulful. I mean, there's soulful and there's intellectual as well. You know, you had John Coltrane who just played all kinds of different styles of music, but always from the heart, always from the soul. And then you have people like Lee Morgan who are just extremely soulful and fiery and, you know, from the Shirley Scotts, and the list goes on and on. There's just so many fabulous musicians. I want this music to be heard by everyone, not only by many people in Philadelphia who may not have a chance to experience it, but to go in the state of Pennsylvania or nationally or internationally to bring this sound to the world would be incredible.
But it must be an interesting challenge to bring all those here's this sound to bring all these people together and try to create that sound through the instruments, the playing of a diverse group of people.
You know, it's not so bad because, first of all, it seems like all the time, you know, people are contributing charts and I'll call someone and ask them to contribute music. So we're building our library. And of course, Wynton has been great in supporting us to help us build that library. But everyone in the group, it's amazing. After the first rehearsal, everyone came together with a concept to make the best music possible. The key part of it all for me and you know, what really represents Philadelphia is the education, making sure that the students in the city, you know, students in the different colleges, universities, high schools benefit from this group and the talent that this group has. So Temple University is very involved and very supportive of this group, and the students at the school come out to rehearsals, they come out to the concerts, they get to talk to the players. So it's a great mentoring group, and hopefully it'll just keep expanding.
Can I assume you're playing, or are you conducting, or what will you be performing with the orchestra?
I do. I do more conducting, and I may play maybe one song, concert or two. I didn't want to make it about me because it's not about me. It's about what's been contributed in this great city, and if I can do something to lead a group to expose, you know, the world to this music and to the great musicians of Philadelphia, I will. I just don't want to make it. I can, you know. I'm not good about that anyway.
Is that true?
Yeah, well, even with my students, I don't like to play with my students. I want it to be always about them, you know, and sometimes it can start to lean the other way. So I try to make it about them and to make let them experience what I've had the opportunity to experience. And on this, the CD that we did that with Love was a time that I did play with my students, and it was a struggle.
Yeah.
I called Jimmy Heath and I said, you know, I know I've been asked to play, you know, and the dean at Temple, Robert Stroker, is really, really supportive. He goes, I think you should play and highlight some of the faculty on this CD. And I was like, ugh. And so Jimmy Heath said to me the greatest words of wisdom. He goes, you know, the only way as a teacher you can really find out what you've done as a teacher is to have the opportunity to perform with your students. If the students are the caliber that you are at, then you've done your job. So he said, consider it a blessing and an honor to have the opportunity to perform with your students. And I did that for this CD.
I was doing some research about you in preparation for today's show, and I think it was Jimmy Heath and some others said about you is that you're a good listener. Do you think you are?
I think I am. I mean, I've been kind of taught to be a good listener just because of my eyes. You know, I've been dyslexic forever.
Is that true?
Yeah, I'm severely dyslexic. And my mom was a reading specialist, and she's helped me. And she's had her friends who are different reading specialists really help me. And they've taught me how to make it through life being severely dyslexic. So
it's hard to read?
It's hard to read, yeah. It's hard to read, and it's hard for me to read out loud if I'm reading a script or something like that. It's the real makes even speaking about it now makes me a nervous wreck.
Right.
So, yeah, and so it can affect you know, music sometimes. So what I do is I listen closely, not only to when I hear people speak, but also in a musical environment as well, so that I can be one step up on this situation.
What about reading notes? I mean, are notes different from letters, words?
Notes are a little bit different. So for notes, when I sight read something for the first time, I'm usually really good at it. And then after that, when I get a comfort level, then I can look at a rhythm and totally forget how it goes. It's just like a word. I'll look at a word and totally forget how to say it, totally forget, you know, even a word like the, you know, I'll totally forget, like, how do you spell, you know. So it does affect, you know, music, and consequently, you become a better listener, so that you can overcome this.
And we'll close out my interview with local jazz great Terrell Stafford with the song Rain Check. That's the first track off his 2013 album, This Side of Strayhorn. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for listening.